Hi, Calvin.
Hi, Ada.
Calvin, we are now continuing a series of talks which we started yesterday, and we are talking at the main level about tetrionics, which you discovered around 5 years ago. You were working with triangles as a model, and you discovered that from that perspective you could actually fit the Planck quantum in the triangle, include all of the electromagnetic effects into that model, as a result of which you created tetrionics. You've written a series of books about that, and we are now in the second part of the exploration of the concept of photons and light, mm-hmm. electromagnetic fields. And in the previous session, I started with a brief introduction of the importance of photons in our life, that in our body we can see that it is all over the place. It is the basis of everything. Actually, when you look at the mechanics of our body, you can see that it is about the relationship between the photon jump connecting to the electron jump, connecting to the electron bonding, connecting to the electron formation. Basically, that would be the transition from the light field to the electromagnetic, to the chemical, to the physical. And so that's why we got into this exploration about light. Also, because there's a lot of technology which now hinges on that, uses that, explores that. And in the previous session, you explained that we definitely have to think differently about photons. Photons are not a particle. In tetrionics, you started with the idea that a photon might actually be a tetrahedron, and then you discovered that that could not be the case. And in earlier sessions, you already thoroughly explained that we must make a distinction between matter, which is three-dimensional, as a tetrahedron would be, and mass, mm-hmm. or inertia, or energy in continuity, which is flat, like a triangle. Mm-hmm. And so, in the previous talk, you already applied that understanding to the photon, said the photon is not a particle, it is actually a double boson. And for everybody who wants to know more of that, that's why it is now available as a recording. But we also had the idea to follow your partition into four parts. First start with a photon, which we did in the previous talk, then go with the electromagnetic field and how that works, which is the purpose of this talk, so that as a result of that we can look at the discovery which you made of how the spectral lines in atomic physics actually are part of this whole story, and very logically and concisely connects up. And then at the fourth level, we can look at interference fields and the technology that connects up to that. Mm. So for now, it would be really neat if you continued the story, building up on what we already know of the photon in relationship to the boson in the electromagnetic field, and the way photons can actually lead to the formation of matter and vice versa. Mm-hmm. But that, for that deeper understanding, you said we need to know more about the way the electromagnetic field can be modeled in tetrionics, and that's of course why we do all these interviews. So please, tell more about what you found.
For sure, thanks, Otto. Obviously, having discussed photons in the previous lecture, a lot of the groundwork's been laid because, as we've discussed, tetrionics is at its heart just a geometric interpretation of physics. We use the geometry to give us shapes and fields, and to differentiate between mass and matter, as you said, via geometry and topology. But where we discussed the photon, we really laid the ground rules and the basic geometry for all electromagnetic waves. And just to recap very quickly on the basics leading into an EM wave and its constituent properties as we measure it. In the QM ebook, right at the beginning in chapter 00, illustration number 5, we've got an illustration that just shows us the geometry of odd numbers, or odd number quanta in this particular case, and how they relate to two distinct properties of quantum mechanics, and that is the energy levels of electromagnetic fields themselves, most familiar to people as quantum jumps, for example, of photons or electrons, photoelectrons in atomic nuclei, or the Bohr radius, things like that. It's just the energy transition. It's how we make the square numbers in quantum mechanics itself. And as you can see from the illustration, the first thing that's immediately obvious is that it's color-coded according to these odd-numbered energy levels ranging from N1 through to N9, as you can see in view there. And each energy level is made up of an odd number of Planck quanta. And as we discussed, odd number Planck quanta are bosons. So you can view each color in this spectra that's here in this equilateral field as a W boson, be it plus or minus charge is irrelevant for this particular discussion. Suffice to say that each boson is a trapezoidal shape, starting with an equilateral shape for a single quanta and building it up as it's color-coded. The interesting thing that comes out of this, obviously, is that when you add odd number quanta together in series, 1 plus 3 plus 5 plus 7 plus 9 as shown in the illustration, you actually create squared numbered fields which have an equilateral geometry. And that's the foundational postulate of tetrionics, that the squared numbers in physics are in fact reflecting equilateral geometries, not squared geometries. The other interesting thing that comes out of this is that mathematically you represent odd numbers as being 2n minus 1 or 2n plus 1. And what quickly becomes evident in tetrionics is that this 2n minus 1 can represent deceleration, and 2n plus 1 can represent acceleration. By that I simply mean that if you increase the quanta in a field by an odd number, or the next sequential odd number, 2n plus 1, you increase the energy momenta in the field. So therefore there's more Planck quanta able to do work. So the particle associated with that field or within that field of interaction will be accelerated. If you remove an odd quanta, there's less energy available to do work, so therefore the particle will decelerate, will slow down. And this is the basics of Newtonian mechanics. So we can see an immediate connection between odd numbers, the trapezoidal or odd quanta geometry of bosons, acceleration, Newtonian mechanics, and quantum levels. So at this fundamental starting point, we have an immediate unification of Newtonian mechanics and quantum mechanics, something that's been lacking to date. We then step on to illustration 6, and we now move from quantum levels back to the familiar geometry of photons within that scalar EM field. Again, we have an equilateral field, electromagnetic field of energy momenta, but in this case, instead of measuring left to right or transversely, we measure longitudinally, as we've discussed before. And you can see the highlighting of the odds and even number of the quanta, but we're really focusing on paired quanta, dual bosons, or what we call photons. And we can quickly see that mathematically they can be represented as being 2n, or even numbers within the equilateral field. And in this case, we have an example where the squared number of the quanta in the field, because all equilateral fields are squared quanta, is actually an odd number in itself. It's 9 squared, which gives 81, an odd number. So when we go to measure the photon content within that field, we have a row of bosons, or half-wavelength photons, across the bottom. So if we were to measure this field as a sine wave, or produces a sine wave as it's measured, we'd see that it stops at a half wavelength frequency. Again, it's purely a function of the geometry. So if we talk bosons, we talk odd numbers. If we're talking photons, we're talking about even numbers. And that's basic mathematics. Illustration number 8, 00.08, then highlights the square root linear momentum that's contained within a field, along with its vector velocity. The square root linear momentum is mass times velocity, and they're the diamond shaped or dual equilateral shapes that make up the height of the equilateral field. And that's where the force of the field is generated and focused to the apex of the triangle. It points in the direction of motion, or the direction of propagation, depending whether you're talking a field or a particle in motion. And these scalar photons, or bosons, however you want to term them, in that make up that square root, then produce a vector velocity in that direction. And you can see that shown as a pink arrow in this case, versus the equilateral geometries that also form that vector direction. And that simply differentiates between momentum, mass velocity, and vector velocity itself. So we've got a geometric representation of both properties. Of course, the momentum, mass velocity, has a scalar component, the mass. That's why we have a differentiated geometry for this square root. But you can see straight from that illustration there, we have 81 quanta. It's a n squared energy field. And the square root, the height, or the bisector line, the square root linear momentum, if you count the triangles up, you'll find that they add up to be 9, as illustrated there, which is the square root of 81. So again, we've now got odd number bosons, even numbered photons, and square root linear momentum, which creates a vector velocity in the same direction. Of course, as we touched on, this linear momentum is always a positive value, irrespective of whether we've got a positive or a negative charge field. And those fields can be represented mathematically via Euler's equation as minus I and plus I. So again, the geometry is the foundation for the mathematics and the complex equations that we derive. 4.08 simply shows us what happens, what type of fields we can create when we couple two bosons, or 2n bosons, an even number of bosons together. What we see immediately is that the vector linear momentum of the two fields is in opposition, so it cancels out, and we create static EM fields. There's two types of static EM fields that we can create out of this geometry, and they're shown both there. Firstly, there's positive and negative electrostatic fields, where the electric component is enhanced because we have similar charges coming together, two positive bosons, or two negative bosons to create a charge field where the magnetic component is neutralized. The north and south poles are in opposition and cancel out. Equivalently, we can also bring a positive and a negative charge field or quanta together, and we can create what are normally termed magnetic fields, but they're actually magnetostatic. That there's no motion because the vectors again cancel out. But in this case, it's the positive and negative E fields that sum to zero and cancel, whereas the north and south magnetic fields of these two bosons coming together form a enhanced magnetic field. So we detect it as a magnetic field as opposed to an electric field of the electrostatic. It's simply the geometry and the type of quanta that come together that produce either one of these two types of fields. In both cases, they're static fields. So in the case of a bar magnet, the bottom illustrations are representative of the electromagnetic field of a bar magnet. We detect the magnetic components, the dipole of the bar magnet, but what we haven't detected till date or realized is there is the electric components, positive and negative. And by not having this geometry, our lack of understanding of the geometry, more precisely, is what led us to special relativity, or led Einstein to formulate special relativity. He needed to explain where the electromotive force comes from when you move a wire about a magnet or a magnet about a wire. He interpreted it differently, but what we see here is the geometry, the fact that the electric fields are cancelled does not negate the fact that they exist. So we have a geometric interpretation that's at odds with the mathematical formulation of magnetic fields. It explains all the properties, but it does so geometrically. Of course, in 4.11, what we show is that either with the electrostatic or the magnetic fields, either field will produce differing forces, but all of these forces, whether they're magnetic fields or electrostatic fields, can be modeled using simple geometries of photons and EM waves, where photons are 2 pi bosons and EM waves are an even number of photons. And when you model the flux of these, of the electric and magnetic components of these fields, as they superposition, we create vector forces, which gives us Coulomb's constant, Newton's gravitational constant. Not to say that Newton's is a electromagnetic force, but we've had this discussion where the electromagnetic fields are a component of gravitational fields. They all have the same geometry. We can model the flux of energy electrically via the angular momentum, or we can measure and draw magnetic vectors or E-field vectors straight from the geometry. We touched yesterday in illustration 26.16 on how using this geometry of photons and our understanding that quantized angular momentum is an equilateral geometry, that we can now show the energy, frequency, wavelength, and velocity of propagation properties of a electromagnetic wave as a relationship of angular momentum at the most fundamental quantum scale of physics. So we end up with this geometric formulation for the frequency wavelength relationship to velocity of propagation, and that again highlights the relationship between wavelength, wave numbers, frequency and charge in quantum physics or quantum mechanics as a property of equilateral geometries. In the case of electromagnetic fields, again, we have 2 pi, or as illustrated there, an even number of photons or quanta in that electromagnetic field. And these measurements are what create our values of frequency and wavelength per second. 27.04 then simply represents these 2 pi or 2 n pi electromagnetic fields as a diamond geometry. And as you can see here, the geometry then forms the basis of the wave function, Schrodinger's wave function for an electromagnetic field. You can see that we start off with a simple photon, which is the lowest quanta we can have, N1 if you like. We can then step up, just as we do with quantum levels, we can step up the energy of these electromagnetic fields by adding additional quanta, which again form, in this case, a squared number of photons. The squared number of bosons gives us an equilateral electrostatic field. Where we have a squared number of photons, we have an energy increase of an electromagnetic field. And this electromagnetic field can be anywhere where we find fields. They could be stars, they could be bar magnets, it could be molecules. Anywhere that has a field of energy, be it thermal energy or inherent energy, that it's a spectral energy that it's trying to release excess amounts of. What we have is, as shown there, in the center of the illustration, from the polar view of the particle looking down on it, these electromagnetic diamond-shaped fields radiate outwards. And if we measure the points of the field, or the bosons, the transverse sections that are of the same energy momenta, equipotential if you like, we can draw these fields from a polar view as concentric rings, getting weaker as they radiate further out. And that's the traditional model of a electrostatic field, a circular potential gradient of electric fields. But we now know that from this geometry, we have magnetic fields associated with it, and whether it's a magnetic EM field or a electrostatic EM field is purely determined by the makeup of the charges, the charge quanta or bosons within those fields. Again, from a polar view, it's just radiated lines that go out equidistant in all directions from the source point. Turning that on its side, what's hidden in the traditional model of the charged particle and its fields is this equilateral geometry. And that's what you can see right beside it. It's the side elevation, if you like, where you can see the electric and the magnetic components. You can see that they're propagating outwards at C, or the speed of light in a vacuum. And more interestingly enough, as shown there in the indigo colored or highlighted sections, the electric fields of any EM field, electrostatic field or electromagnetic field, forms a toroid, a donut shaped field, and that's where a lot of zero point fields and zero point energy work gets focused. But it's only half the picture. Where you see a lot of devices that use toroidal windings, or like in fusion power plants, generators as they call them, which don't actually work, you can see that they're creating the windings to create a magnetic containment field for the plasma to flow in the toroidal section. In that case, what they're doing is they're creating a model of the electric field components and neglecting the magnetic components. If you want to make a true model of electromagnetic fields, you need to model both. And you can see here, as we step up the energy levels of the wave functions for each field type, the distribution of the photons remains as a normal distribution, but the number of quanta in that distribution changes. And as the energy is increased, we get a more pronounced linear momentum component. It's always there, but it gets stronger and stronger, so there's more force radiating out from these central points as we add more energy. And again, these illustrations highlight the photon components. If we were to look at the boson components, the color coding would be perpendicular to the color coding that you see there. Of course, as we add the energy, you can see the physical geometry of the photons is getting smaller. So as we add energy, the frequency increases, the number of quanta of photons increases, but their wavelength decreases. The physical size of the photon gets smaller because we're putting more energy into the field. Maxwell would have expressed it as a compressibility. We're pumping energy into the field, and it's being compressed within that field to create a tension. And that tension is what gives electricity its power. Because as you put more energy momentum in there, obviously you have more linear momentum that can exert a force from the source. 2705 simply gives us the geometry of photons in an EM wave. We can see that an EM wave is made up of many, many photons, all of the same geometry as the EM wave itself. And we can see that irrespective of the number of quanta, we end up with a scalar set of fields that are electric and magnetic. They have permittivity and permeability, purely because of the geometric relationship of the electric to the magnetic within the field. And they exert a force, again, purely because of the geometry of their square root, linear momentum. These fields, normally we would measure and plot the linear momentum as positive and negative sine waves, and similarly for the magnetic. But with the magnetic, physics tends to draw a unidirectional magnetic vector from south to north, north to south, depending on which books you read. It should be from a south to north, internal to the geometry. And that's what you see on the top left-hand side, the classical drawing of a transverse wave of electromagnetic energy. You see the wavelength indicated there. You see the electric component incorrectly drawn as being positive in all phases when the bottom downward pointing arrow should be negative. And you see the magnetic vector A, which is the south to north internal magnetic dipole direction, indicated as pointing in one direction, unidirectional, and then reversing as the wave, the electric component, goes negative, only to reverse again as it goes positive. As per the discussions with photons, we show geometrically that in fact what's happening when the electric north and south components are changing is that there's a dipole magnetic vector. There's a north-south arrangement that's changing, which is not correctly shown or poorly illustrated, is probably a better phrasing, poorly illustrated by using a magnetic vector. The more appropriate way to draw it is as it's drawn at the bottom right hand corner, where you can see as you look along that section of an EM wave, you can see that you have a changing north, negative positive arrangement of electric fields, and then 90 degrees out of phase you have a magnetic dipole that is also alternating. In Tetrionics I tend to say that the electric field oscillates and the magnetic field alternates, just to differentiate between them as well, because the terminology can be somewhat confused. And you can also see in that bottom right hand illustration the magnetic vector A, as it should be shown if you were to use it, and you can see that it in fact alternates from one field to the next. And again, this becomes important when you look at applying Euler's formulation to electromagnetic waves, and it's important in understanding why solar panels as they're currently designed are inefficient. 2706 gives us a full breakdown of an electromagnetic wave form. You can see in the center we have our photon, which just says that we can model the scalar components, electromagnetic components of an EM wave, exactly as we do for a photon. The geometry of the photon dictates what the geometry of an EM wave is, and vice versa. So the geometric relationship is what's important, not so much the mathematical. The mathematical formulation is simply describing the geometric pattern that is produced by these boson geometries or photons. You can see that as per the middle of the diagram, if we take a sample slice through the electromagnetic field, we have this alternating electric field and oscillating magnetic field, again occurring within the geometry of electromagnetic waves. And if we separate the electric from the magnetic, as we do at the right-hand side, we can measure points of those fields that are the same potential and same intensity as concentric rings radiating out from a source point. So the electromagnetic wave will propagate from the center outwards in both directions, just as a photon does, because that's what they're comprised of. And these photons and electromagnetic waves will have component electric fields and magnetic fields that can be mapped as equipotential concentric circles. And if you combine them both, you can get the mapping of electromagnetic field radiating from a central point, as shown in the center of the right-hand side. Equivalently, on the left-hand side, we have a full breakdown of the actual geometry of the electric and magnetic components of any electromagnetic field. And you can see it in this case, in the very center of the left-hand side, the proper representation of a transverse waveform, where we have a dipole magnetic vector oscillating, as well as the alternating electric field, and then 90 degrees out of phase. That is to say, when the electric is at its maximum, the magnetic is at its minimum. And when the magnetic is at its maximum, the electric is at its minimum. Then 90 degrees out of phase. That relationship is purely the result of the equilateral fields that you can see drawn there. And I encourage people to, again, break out the templates, create the models, put them together in a long chain, and then put some more photons beside it until you make the equilateral geometry of an EM wave. and you'll see this pattern and you'll begin to understand it a lot more as it's represented here. Again, there's no substitution for physically manipulating the models. 2707 shows us a major difference in the understanding of electromagnetic fields from tetrionic geometries. We now see and can differentiate between transverse waveforms, that's Hertzian Maxwell wave equations, and differentiate them between transverse waveform to that of a longitudinal. And the differentiation really comes down to the orientation of the field with respect to its direction of motion. Just to explain that, you can see that both of these fields, even though they're 90 degrees in opposition to each other, left to right versus up to down, are in fact the same electromagnetic field. If you look at those geometries, they are identical. If you rotate it, that geometry 90 degrees, you'll end up with the same geometry. The differentiation of the field and its forces comes about purely because of the direction of motion. In the case of Hertzian fields or transverse oscillations, as illustrated on the left-hand side of that diagram, you can see that the linear momentum of the field and the component photons is up and down with respect to direction of velocity from left to right. So what we have there is, as illustrated on the left-hand side, a planar field that is orthogonal or perpendicular to the direction of motion. So if it encounters a charged particle, the charged particle will feel the force of the momentum in an up and down fashion, an oscillation. And that's what happens when we transmit radio waves. We transmit the power, and at the far distance at the antenna, where the field interacts with the antenna, the electrons oscillate up and down. The field loses energy as it goes over distance, but it's this transverse oscillation that makes up our radio wave technology at present. Tesla, in his research with DC discharges, discovered that there was another form of propagation, and that was where the linear momentum, the square root energy, the vector force of the EM wave is collinear with the direction of propagation, as illustrated on the right. It's just a phase change of 90 degrees. We've just rotated the field so that it points in the direction of propagation. But the change in effect is pronounced. Instead of oscillating a charge that it encounters up and down, in this case as illustrated, it accelerates the charge. That is, it physically moves it in the direction of motion of the field. And this acceleration is completely different to what's produced in the oscillation of transverse fields as described by Maxwell and practically developed by Hertz. This is the field orientation that Tesla was experimenting with. This is the field direction that stars utilize to radiate their energy, and that nature uses in most of its cases. And this is the field type that we've ignored in physics to date. So if you were to describe modern physics and its understanding of EM wave or EM fields, you would only have the up and down diamond that's illustrated here, and you'd be missing the left to right transverse waves that were described by Tesla. Tesla, lacking the geometry, and Maxwell Hertz even lacking the geometry, were unable to explain what we have here in the geometry. The geometry gives us the differentiation between transverse and longitudinal waves. And more importantly, it shows us the physical effects that rotating an EM field 90 degrees can have on charged particles. And the Tesla field is where Eric Dollard and others like that and a lot of the zero-point energy community are generating their results. These results obviously aren't covered by current physical theory because they're 90 degrees out of phase. And you'll see discussion of electromagnetic fields in zero-point communities as being rotated or being longitudinal versus transverse, obviously. Or they can be described as imaginary directions or imaginary components compared to the normal components of electromagnetic fields. What they're all hinting at via the math is this geometry where we have two directions that are possible for the EM wave, and depending on its direction of motion with respect to the charge, we have different forces produced 90 degrees out of phase with each other. And in fact, where you see the Q in the middle of these two field forms, you could think of that as a singularity or a point source of an electromagnetic field, what creates the field. And in the case of most point sources, be they electrons or be they stars at the other end of the scale, the field geometry that we see here is what they produce. Albeit they produce a huge number of these fields at varying angles that radiate out from the point. In this case, this illustration, the magnetic vector would be the orthogonal direction to the EM fields. And you can see the orthogonal magnetic component by looking at the magnetic fields. The south field is closest to us, with the north field the furthest from us, depending on the field orientation. But what we have is an electric component with an orthogonal magnetic within these field components, and the geometry of tetrionics makes this easily evident to view, but the mathematics is very complex. And in fact, there are several mathematical forms that it can be expressed in. Heaviside, Maxwell's equations, pure Gaussian equations, equipotential mapping, many, many different ways of describing electromagnetic fields that at their source are those fields that we've just drawn. As I touched on, 2708 gives us the way we can produce these longitudinal waves that Tesla spoke about, and that is through a what's called a disruptive DC discharge, a spark gap. In the early 1900s, spark gaps were the common source for radio waves, and they quickly faded out of use as we moved to solid state oscillation or oscillators, LC circuits, where instead of a spark gap, we used the LC circuit to create the electromagnetic field. Again, the LC circuit creates a transverse waveform, whereas the DC discharge used by Tesla and others and early radio systems creates a longitudinal discharge, 90 degrees out of phase with each other, but they are identical waveforms comprised of identical photons. As we increase the energy of either waveform, the frequency increases, and the wavelength gets shorter for the photons within the field. Interestingly enough, transverse waveforms are normally measured as in terms of their frequency, the hertz, the cycles per second, because it's measuring the instantaneous number of quanta per second, because it's an up and down field moving past a point, whereas longitudinal discharges are usually measured as a voltage or a force. And you'll see that in Tesla's work. A lot of the time he just refers to the momenta impulses that it created, or the force, or the voltage, the number of the energy per charge that was available or created by the discharge. So if you see EM waves measured as a frequency, you know immediately that it's the up-down geometry we just discussed. They're transverse waves. Whereas if you see them measured in terms of the force that they can apply, or how fast they can accelerate particles, the voltage, then you know that you're measuring longitudinal disruptive discharges. And they're the types of discharges that are normally found in nature. Lightning waves, little lightning bolts, radiated energy from stars, etc. Even electromagnetic fields and spectral lines are produced as more a DC longitudinal waveform, far more often than you find transverse waveforms in nature. The interesting part, as we've touched on with the longitudinal energy momenta, is shown in 2709, where we can see, looking at the geometry, how the linear momentum of the photons lines up to form a chain and exert a force over a distance. So again, this just highlights the fact that longitudinal discharges, or EM waves, are a particular arrangement of photons, where the pronounced effect of the photons arrangement is that of a force or a voltage, rather than a frequency or an oscillation. And that illustration just shows how it's focused at a point rather than spread out as a field in the case of transverses. In fact, as in 2710, Wheatstone in the 1800s measured these forces and set up an experiment with DC discharges over great distances in order to measure the velocity of light, or the velocity of electricity, more accurately, in different media. And from that, he measured a velocity in excess of that of the speed of light. And this has caused some consternation. It's a very simple experiment. You simply have a DC discharge, as illustrated in the center. You allow that to propagate through a length of wire. In the case of Wheatstone, he had several miles, or the equivalent of several miles, using inductors. And then he had a break at the end of these long lengths of wire, where a secondary DC discharge could be created. And he simply timed the time between the first discharge and the two end discharges through that length of wire and calculated the propagation velocity. And as you can see there, it came out to be pi divided by 2 by c, or about 1.5 times the speed of light. What he didn't understand at the time, and what we can now see using the geometry, is that it's the propagation of the energy of the linear momentum that travels faster than the speed of light, not the electrical energy itself, not the EM component, but the linear momentum that travels faster than C. So if you like, as Tesla put it, it's the impulses that travel faster than the speed of light, not the electromagnetic wave. And when you view it as that, using the geometry, you can then reconcile that experimental result with relativity, which states that energy is limited to the speed of light. And we now show that linear momentum, if created by a DC discharge, can in fact propagate faster than the speed of light, and reconcile this practical experiment with relativity theory and also with quantum theory, because we do so by using the geometry of photons to explain this effect, whereas at present it's completely unable to be reconciled with relativity theory. So it tends to be a known effect that's more or less ignored in electrical theory. 27011 just delves that little bit further into the linear momentum impulses. I won't go into detail here, other than to say to have a look at this and note that once a DC discharge field is created, we can in fact effect a faster than light communication or impulse in both directions between two points. So where we have in this case a positive E field and a negative E field, but they could both be positive, makes no difference. Where the E fields are created, the electrostatic fields, and they propagate out to interact with another material body and its fields, the linear momentum of the longitudinal fields will establish a faster than light instantaneous, more or less near instantaneous means of information transfer between two points. This is how gravity was described by Newton, as a action at a distance, an instantaneous action at a distance. This is one of the conflicts between Newton's gravitational formulation and Einstein's. Einstein's gravitational formulation is limited to the speed of light. It raises the problem that the Earth cannot respond to the Sun's gravitational input based on where the Sun is now. It can only react to where the Sun is 8.5 minutes ago. It's a major problem in general relativity, which for the sake of keeping general relativity at the forefront is pushed to the background. Newton's formulation does not have a time component, therefore there's an instantaneous action at a distance. We now show that just like Coulomb's law, this instantaneous action at a distance is in fact a bidirectional action at a distance, equal and opposite, dependent on the strength of the fields. And we can in fact employ this, as we'll discuss in the last lecture coming up, as a technology to facilitate faster than light communication between two points, irrespective of the distance between them. So to sum up the orientation of longitudinal fields, 27.12 simply plots the various polarizations that a longitudinal field can have. And again, the longitudinal field is where the square root vector linear momentum is in the same direction as the velocity of propagation. So the forces create a voltage, or are measured as a voltage. But we can, in addition to having this longitudinal direction, or this longitudinal type of field, we can also polarize it. We can rotate the field laterally 90 degrees, so that there's additional polarizations and orientations of magnetic fields within the longitudinal field, and we can use that to encode additional information and do many, many other things with it as well. So the next slide, 2713, simply highlights the difference between Tesla's longitudinal waveforms measured as volts seconds per meter squared and Hertzian waves, transverse waves, which are measured in cycles per second or Hertz. And you can see there quite clearly the difference between the two waveforms. In the case of the right-hand Hertzian waves, we have they will produce an up and down oscillation. They are planar waves moving through space, and they're inefficient in terms of accelerating or exerting a force. They can only oscillate a particle in a set position. They cannot move it physically. Whereas Tesla's fields, the electrostatic longitudinal waves, concentrate all that energy momenta into a EM field that expresses all that energy momenta as a voltage, as a physical force that you can feel. If you create a spark gap discharge and get close to it, you can feel the air rushing out, created by these linear momenta radiating out. In fact, Tesla used it at Colorado to help cool and circulate air through his lab. It creates a physical force, just like a fan blowing air, whereas the transverse waves do not have that effect. Again, transverse waves, as shown in 27.14, can be polarized, just like the longitudinals. The only difference being that their square root linear momentum is orthogonal or perpendicular to the direction of the wave's propagation, whereas longitudinals exert that force, the transverse waves cannot exert it because the linear momentum is at 90 degrees to the vector velocity. And again, we can have information stored within the electric and magnetic fields and the polarization of the fields. This is how we create AM waves and FM waves. And 27.15 simply covers EM wave modulations, the various ways of encoding information into electromagnetic waves so that we can increase the information content of the waves. So not only can they exert a physical force that can propagate faster than the speed of light, we can encode the impulses to contain information, and we can also encode the arrangement of electric and magnetic fields and the frequency of the photons within those fields to contain information. So we have AM, FM, and in the case of longitudinal waves, we can create a form of pulsed modulation, or I prefer to call it impulse modulation, a bit like Morse code, where we increase the field at one end and it increases the force created, so you can measure those force changes at the far end as a change of voltage. And that opens the door to technologies to measuring real-time activity of the sun, as opposed to the delayed measurements that we have presently, again, that we discuss in later lectures. So 27.16 now shows that in the case of the photoelectric effect, or more actually, probably even more accurately, in the case of current radio wave oscillations, transverse waves, how we produce it. We produce it by simply applying a alternating energy source to a photon, sorry, to a electron, the energy of the oscillation is stored in the chem field of the electron, which turns it into a photoelectron. But because it's an AC waveform, it's oscillating as part of the LC circuit, what happens is that the direction of the chem field alternates in line with the force that's applied to it. So in order to, in the case of an oscillating electron, as shown there, in order to go from one direction to the other, the electron has to give up the energy in its chem field. It has to give up all the energy and build up energy in the opposite direction. So the photon moves up and down in a stationary point. It's not actually moving left to right, it's just oscillating up and down. And as it oscillates up and down, the energy that it releases in order to change direction is radiated out into free space as an electromagnetic wave. That's how we create transverse EM waves at present. The alternating voltages applied, those voltages, the photon energy, the Planck quanta of those voltages, are turned into chem field energies that have to be released and then recreated in an alternating fashion. That in turn creates the alternating transverse waveforms that propagate out into space. And the opposite occurs at the other end. These radiated chem fields or EM fields interact with the electrons of an antenna, and all their energy accelerates the electrons at the other in the antenna to move up and down, and that in turn creates a AC waveform that we can amplify at the antenna end. It's obviously weaker because as the electromagnetic field propagates through free space, it's subject to the inverse squared law, so it gets weaker over distance. And that's why the transverse waveforms are lesser efficient, and you can see that in 27.19. again, we're just illustrating the geometry of Tesla's longitudinal waves versus Maxwell's or Hertzian transverse waveforms. They're the same EM waveforms with the same number of quanta and the same arrangement of quanta within them, so the information's identical. The only difference is a 90 degree phase change, and the result is Tesla's spark gap longitudinal EM waves produce an instantaneous action at a distance, whereas the Hertzian Maxwell transverse waveforms simply oscillate charges at a distance. They can't produce a physical force like the Tesla waves can. We can now draw all these relationships, as we do in 3801 for electromagnetic waves, and we can show, as shown here, a complete wave function, which is behind the five individuals that are illustrated. And to the right, we can see that we can split that wave function up depending on how we measure it. We can measure it as a voltage field, plus and minus, or as Planck quanta, transverse bosons, which are charges, so alternating charges of different charge potentials depending where we're measuring the wave at what point, or we can measure the frequency, the number of photons at any instant of time, as in a transverse wave, or if it's rotated 90 degrees, we measure it as a voltage, a physical force, the number of quanta or energy per charge per coulomb. That's what voltage is. Or we can combine these measurements as shown there on the bottom left hand to give us a measure of the energy, either in terms of mass velocity squared or linear momentum squared. Both terms are equivalent to each other. They're both measures of scalar energy. And in both cases, we have two equilateral geometries. So again, we have two squared number fields, or squared number of quanta in the fields. If you, instead of again applying bosons to photons, odds versus evens, these two squared fields can be represented as a single photon, or squared number of photons. Instead of 64 positive and 64 negative, you could express it as 64 photons made up of positive and negative. Again, you can see on the center, between the bottom left hand and the bottom right hand, you can see that the cross section of the electromagnetic field is comprised of changing electric and magnetic field geometries 90 degrees out of phase with each other. Oscillating electric charges, alternating magnetic fields, all related to each other via the photon geometry, and that comprises the geometry of electromagnetic fields. So mapping these photon distributions, we then get a distribution, or an energy distribution, if you like, a wave function of electromagnetic waves, and that's what's represented at the bottom right hand side illustration. That the color coding shows us the lower energy photons, or the lowest probability of finding a photon in the field, resides at the far right hand and left hand spatial extents. And all these probability distributions can be renormalized or add up to one. So all the wave functions of electromagnetic fields have now been summarized. We've covered bosons, photons, energy momenta, voltage, frequency, wavelength, energy distribution, square root linear momenta, vector forces that can be created, all from a simple geometry of photons and the corresponding scalar wave function that they create in electromagnetic fields. And in 38.03, we simply reproduce that orientation, or the geometry, and we show how that all relates back to the quadrature wave function that's best described as a formula, and that formula is Euler's formula, e to the I pi equals plus 1 equals 0, or e to the I pi equals negative 1. We seem to be breaking up there a bit. Do you want to stop it at that stage, Otto? Or?
Yeah, let's reconnect, but we keep the quality of the sound. And
yeah.
Simply continue. One moment, please. I'll just make the switch.